Jewish spirituality, Muslim spirituality, Hindu spirituality, etc. And it is also distinctive from non-religion-based spiritualities like 12-step spirituality and New Age spirituality. The Christian tradition as a whole has distinctive features about it, and all kinds of Christian spiritualities have common features. The presence of Jesus as an important element in that spirituality would be one of them that makes it different from other kinds. Jesus is right front and center in Christian spirituality, which is not the case for other kinds of spirituality. I could mention other things that that Christian spiritualities have in common, but what I have attempted to do, inspired, I suppose, by Roman Catholic theologians who have, in the past couple of centuries, set forth the concept of different spiritual movements within the Catholic Church and giving them the name of a spirituality. For example, Benedictine spirituality, Jesuit spirituality, Franciscan spirituality, or lay spirituality. Those kinds of distinctions point out that there are different flavors, different styles, different types of the ways in which the Christian tradition has been understood and lived out by different communities. Not that they don't have a lot in common with each other, but they emphasize different aspects of the Christian message. Now, a spirituality is not a theology, nor a philosophy. It is lived experience. A spirituality is a way of relating. And a spirituality includes a number of different disciplines or habits which form the daily rhythm of life in a particular spirituality. So, in the history of Christian spirituality, there have been many spiritualities in the sense that I've just been speaking about, and I've attempted to write about these in my little book called Thirsty for God, and I'm showing it to you to help the bookstore, because they would like you to come up and have a look or buy a copy. And so I make this known to you. There is, in the Thirsty for God, there are the 12 steps that we're going to talk about today, and a brief discussion about 12-step spirituality, together with discussions of Eastern Orthodox, Roman Catholic, and Protestant styles of Christian spirituality, each of which also has a lot of varieties within it. It's also, this book is an attempt to include people other than Europeans and North Americans in the story of Christian spirituality. That's important to me. Having lived in Nigeria for several years, my mind was changed about a number of things. And one of them is that Christianity is not a European religion. And we who have European background do not have a copyright on the gospel, as if it belonged to us more than to people with darker skins. Jesus himself probably was a lot darker than we are, in spite of our attempts to blondify him. So these are some of the ideas that have gone together into this book. And in the last chapter, I attempt to survey American spirituality. And here is where I have a section on New Age, which we discussed a couple of days ago, and 12-step spiritualities. So the question that I'm posing today in this discussion and you may like to take it in other directions, is if we take Christian spiritualities as plural and the varieties of them, and then we put them alongside this 20th century American movement called 12-step, or beginning with Alcoholics Anonymous, what affinities and what differences, what tensions do we see between these two kinds of spirituality? That's the kinds of question I'm asking. Do they fit well together? Do they contradict each other? Does one profit from the other? How do they look in comparison with each other? That's the general kind of question I'm asking today. And as I say, I invite you to take that question in other directions if you prefer. So I'm not planning now to say more about Christian spirituality, with the assumption that you all have quite a bit of experience with different varieties of it in the Lutheran or Catholic or Orthodox traditions, or other Protestant traditions. But I will talk now for a little while about the 12 steps, and then invite you to think about this question that I have raised. The 12 steps were developed by two alcoholics in the 1930s who were known as Dr. Bob and Bill Wilson was his name. These were men who were professional Christian men who had been deeply involved in the Oxford Group, as it was called, which was a movement of Christian spirituality which developed in Oxford in England, and which emphasized absolutes, four absolutes. I'm sorry, I don't remember them all now, but one of them was absolute honesty. This was a movement not based in a denomination or the church particularly, but it surely was a Christian movement. They had been influenced by that movement, but that movement in itself was not enough for them to overcome their addiction to alcohol. They suffered a great deal, and their families suffered a great deal with their addiction. But eventually, and some of you may know or be able to tell the story in more detail than I can, but after several failed experiments, they developed a program which did not end their addiction, but led them to a life of sobriety. It was a program of mutual support, which contradicts, in a sense, the title you'll see in the bookstore. You'll find AA materials and 12-step materials under the heading called Self-Help. But in fact, it is helping one another. So part of the secret of the program they developed was that you meet in a group. You don't face this addiction by yourself. And in addition to having the group support, you also have a mentor, one individual, who will give you advice, who will be there for you in time of need, after you've been sober for several months and you're right at the point of taking that drink, there's someone for you to call. Now, if you look at the different elements in the 12-step program, two of which I have mentioned so far, you find that they are repeating things that are part of Christian spiritual tradition. You find the same sorts of things in Christian spirituality: group support, a mentor or spiritual director. These are both part of Christian tradition. And some people would even go so far as to say that you can find biblical sources. Are you off today?
Yeah, off right now.
Go well.
Bye.
Thanks for being with us. That's real dedication to come for 10 minutes about and then get on the bus. Some people would also say that the 12 steps are related to biblical teachings, and there are books around that lay that out very carefully. Yet, the 12-step program is very consciously and very explicitly not Christian. It is an attempt to be generic as far as its spirituality is concerned. Generic in the sense that a Hindu, a Jew, a Muslim, a Christian, and someone who isn't quite identified with any of these can participate. So many of people who have been addicted to alcohol have met so much rejection and hatred among Christian believers, and have had such difficulties with the Christian God that they could not, Bill and Robert, could not properly say that this was a Christian movement. Now notice, if I could make this distinction right at the early on in the discussion here, and that is that 12-step spirituality is not really of the same kind of thing as Jesuit spirituality or Pietist spirituality among the Lutherans or charismatic spirituality among the Catholics, for example. It's not quite the same sort of thing. It's apples and oranges to some degree, because the 12-step program is a recovery program. It isn't set forth as a school of spirituality for everybody within a certain church tradition. It is rather a goal-oriented spirituality. Now, one of the things about 12-step that bothers me, and I'm sure you'd like to discuss this more later, is the rather upfront distinction between spirituality and religion. I said before that this is a sort of generic approach, and that means that the members of AA don't want to turn off any potential member by identifying it with any religion, because many people have had bad experiences with religions. This leads members of the movement to make such a sharp distinction between spirituality on the one hand and religion on the other that it raises the question of whether there is such a thing as Christian spirituality, or Jewish spirituality, or Muslim spirituality. The two get so separated from each other in this concept. For me, spirituality is an overlapping circle with religion. And it's quite possible for people to find their spiritual home in a faith community, like the Christian church or a Jewish synagogue, for example. The two are not incompatible. Now, many people who have gone through 12-step programs have eventually, starting out with great hostility to the church and to God, as most people understand God, in the course of time of their practice of the 12 steps, have changed their minds completely, have come to the church, have come to Christian faith, have embraced it warmly and deeply, but not everyone has. And my understanding is that in 12-step groups, you will find those who take this spiritual element, which is an important part of the 12 steps, take that element very seriously, and it becomes really the directing feature of their lives. And for other people, it doesn't take off in the same way that it does for some people. There they go, some of them. They have a good send-off party out there. So what are these 12 steps? Let's have a look at them, and then I will open it up for discussion. I'm sorry that this isn't bigger. We tried to see what we could do about making it bigger, but it didn't get very big. Or I wonder if I could put this way over there. I'll read them to you anyhow, or if you'd care to, you can move so you can see them better. The first step is, we admitted we were powerless over alcohol, that our lives had become unmanageable. This is a sort of paradoxical statement, because most of us in America would say you pick yourself up by your bootstraps. You try harder, you work harder. And the experience of many alcoholics is that trying harder doesn't help, and that they are able to remain sober for a while and they fall back. So this is a kind of a radical step. We admitted that we were powerless over alcohol. Now note that the term alcohol here is replaceable with other terms. And the 12-step program has been adopted by people who are interested in overcoming all sorts of addictions, and indeed by people who are not chemically addicted at all, or even in the general sense psychologically addicted, like Shoppers Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous, Overeaters Anonymous.
Yeah.
Pardon?
Gamblers
Anonymous, yes, thank you. And Sex Anonymous, I'm not quite sure the right title of that. There are hundreds, in fact, of such groups who, if you replace the word alcohol with something else, you have the same basic principle. Now, the people who have been addicted to alcohol and who are overcoming that addiction are oftentimes not very happy about the way other groups have adopted it, and specifically Christian groups who have filled it in with various other statements, more general. Because if you've been an alcoholic and have hit bottom and have come up again through AA, that is such a dramatic, life-changing event that it's painful to see people take the same program and use it for lesser ends. I think that's the way to speak about it. But I've heard alcoholics in my classes speak that way with some resentment about this, that you don't realize what you're talking about here because of their experience. Now, I want to connect this first step before we go on with a prayer that many people know and is very commonly used in AA, called the Serenity Prayer, which was composed by Reinhold Niebuhr, a Protestant theologian at the middle of the 20th century. Some of you may have heard Duane, the Bible teacher, mention him on Friday, yesterday. God grant me the grace to accept with serenity the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. That's the way the prayer is often spoken in a 12-step meeting. I want to put that alongside this because some of the critics of 12-step movements have said that it leads you to think that you have no control over your life, that you're totally in bondage and you have no choices in life. I think that the prayer indicates that it's a matter of wisdom to know what can be changed. And obviously the 12-step program is a program for change in your life. So part of our discussion can be a critique of the 12-step program, and there are many books and articles in the last 10 years that have been written criticizing it. One of them has been that if we are powerless, that suggests that all 12-step people are powerless and can't do anything and are just resigning themselves from life. But the prayer suggests otherwise. And the prayer says, I have to accept what I cannot change. And most typically, that's the wisdom to know that I can't change my spouse, my children, my parents, my neighbors, my boss. That it's up to me to learn to live with them because I cannot control them. Beyond that, however, the fact that I am addicted to alcohol may also be something that I cannot change. So I have to learn to live with it. But that doesn't mean that I can't do anything. I need the courage to change the things I can. And the change can be living a life of sobriety, even though I'm addicted to alcohol, or to gambling, or overeating, or some other thing. Let me read you the rest of this prayer, which most people haven't heard, before we move on. God grant me the grace to accept with serenity the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and the wisdom to know the difference, living one day at a time, enjoying one moment at a time, accepting hardship as the pathway to peace, taking as you did this sinful world as it is, not as I would have it, trusting that you will make all things right if I surrender to your will, that I may be reasonably happy in this life and supremely happy with you forever in the next. Amen. That's the whole prayer. The second is, I came to believe that a power greater than ourselves could restore us to sanity, suggesting that addiction is a kind of insanity. The higher power is a commonly used phrase now in our culture, and for people who find the Christian God unacceptable as a higher power, people are urged to adopt something else as their higher power. Perhaps most usefully, the program itself, or the group. Some people have talked about making the doorknob your higher power, but that's kind of ridiculous, I think. Made a decision to turn our will and our lives over to the care of God as we understood Him. So you introduce the term God here in the third step, who is from here on used interchangeably with higher power. So these three first steps are all related together to the beginning spiritual dimension of overcoming an addiction. When I speak to 12-step people and they say, I have discovered my spirituality, I think what they're saying is that they hadn't thought before that their decisions, not only about alcohol but about other things, were involved with a higher power. And they hadn't thought about that before this. And thus they have discovered their spirituality. Now the next few steps let's take 4 through 7 here. We made a searching and fearless moral inventory of ourselves. This is a big step, and people who do it take a lot of time to do it. They write down, they go through their memory. We admitted to God, to ourselves, and to another human being the exact nature of our wrongs. The fifth step is often seen to be a very difficult step. Of course, it has analogies to the Catholic sacrament of penance or reconciliation. But particularly for former Catholics, and perhaps for non-Catholics, we would prefer to just confess our sins to God and in private and leave it at that. In so doing, we deprive ourselves of the power and the assurance of forgiveness. Because we often, inside of ourselves, say, well, I can forgive myself of anything. It's rather a way around to simply forgive myself. Indeed, I need to forgive myself. I'm not suggesting that isn't necessary. But we need something outside ourselves to make it objective, to assure ourselves that this is real and not just something we're making up. And so to speak to another person is often a very dramatic event for people in the 12 steps. And there are a number of clergy and non-clergy who are accustomed to listening to fifth step 12-steppers. Then the sixth, we were entirely ready to have God remove all these defects of character. First, you become willing in number six, and then in number seven, you humbly ask God to remove your shortcomings. So first you get ready, then you actually ask. And then other people are involved. 8 and 9 made a list of all persons we had harmed and became willing to make amends to them all. I like this because this is picking up a teaching of Jesus that the church has largely forgotten. We Lutherans in particular, for those of you who are Lutherans here, are accustomed to thinking that our wrongs are entirely between us and God, and other people don't enter into it. This one suggests that we need to make things right with those we have wronged. And number 9 is to make direct amends to such people wherever possible, except when to do so would injure them or others. The easiest case, of course, is if I have stolen something from you, I can give it back. Zacchaeus did that in the New Testament, but he did it fourfold. He gave back to those he had stolen from. Jesus taught, if you go to make a gift in the temple and remember your brother has something against you, go first and be reconciled with your brother, and then go to the temple and offer your offering. I think this is largely ignored in practical congregational life. There are times when to make amends would injure them or others. And that would be, for example, if you had committed adultery 20 years ago, and many of the people involved may not know about it, and to bring it up now might do more harm than good. So that would be an example of when making amends, there isn't a good way to make amends there. So, contrary to popular Protestant prejudice, This program asks us to speak our sins to somebody and to restore whatever we have done wrong. Then we have sort of the spiritual ones, 10, 11, and 12. Continue to take personal inventory, and when we were wrong, promptly admitted it. One of the things that my spiritual director, who was very much involved in 12-step programs himself, advised me to do is to do examen. Examen is to, at the end of the day or at the beginning of the day, take account of what's happened that day. Not simply to seek out sins, which is my special predilection. We are different, and for some of us, we collect guilt like a fur collects burrs. I mean, it just is a sort of natural for us. And that's my type of person. I easily feel guilty about things where there's no guilt. Then there are other kinds of people who just don't have a much of a sense of guilt at all, and they always think they're in the right. And those people need a different kind of examen than my type of people do. My director said, look for the places where God's grace comes to you that day. As you look back over the day, if you believe that God loves you, where were the hints about that love that you experienced today? Now I invite you to just stop a minute and think about that for yourself. In the last 24 hours, where has God's love been real to you? And again, this is a practice which comes out of the Christian spiritual tradition, particularly the Ignatian tradition. 11, sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for the knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. So it is a kind of spiritual program that one enters into in the 12 steps with prayer and meditation, and not asking for everything under the sun, but asking for God's will to be done. And that, of course, is connected with the earlier step, which has to do with surrendering to God's will. Finally, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry this message to alcoholics and to practice these principles in all our affairs. This is kind of the evangelistic step, where when you see someone else in need, you try to make them aware of what's available in 12-step programs. Are you looking at 12 or 11?
11.
Sought through prayer and meditation to improve our conscious contact with God as we understood Him, praying only for knowledge of His will for us and the power to carry that out. Anyone else like another one reread while we're at it? Okay. Now, what I'd like to do is open the discussion and invite you in. And to ask, I think I'll turn this off for the moment. I'll turn it on again. And if anyone would like to refer to a specific step, I'll turn it on again. And to ask you, either out of your own experience with yourself or with others, with Al-Anon or any of the other 12-step programs, or from what you have read or heard today, if you'd like to comment on what do you see here that is of value, what do you see here that is problematic that would be difficult or that you might object to in either direction?
I can say something about what I've always thought was very valuable about this, or a valuable element within it. I don't have personal experience of it, but I read and read the 12 steps for years, I guess. In the Christian spiritual tradition, there is this common thread, spiritualities, like you say, in the plural. There's a common thread of surrendering one's will. And I've often thought of that as a fundamental beginning place in my Christian journey. So it seems to me if this can be spread widely to people who perhaps would not learn it in church or in another religious context, that that has great value for the society.
Okay, so surrendering one's will to God is valuable both to the person and to the society, you suggest.
Seems to me.
Okay.
I think that some addictions come out of anger. That's it. And I didn't see anything in there where they examine people who they feel have wronged them and have addressed forgiveness of that. They ask to be forgiven, but I find that a missing step or a missing idea, mm-hmm. is to think that through.
On first thought, at least, it sounds right on the mark to me. I know it was important for me when I first started thinking that I was not only a sinner but sinned against in my life, and that if I was going to be healed, I needed to move to the place where I could forgive those who had wronged me, either by neglect or by action. I wonder if, you know, we have this victim mentality in the United States. We all want to be the victim in some way or another. I wonder if alcoholics more easily tend to blame their addiction or their other problems on other people, and this is a way of trying to avoid that kind of victim mentality. I don't know, I'm just speculating. I invite anybody to add another thought here.
I want to just say something about that, which is that I think in the big book of Alcoholics Anonymous, when it talks about step four, the first thing that you do is you write all your resentments. And I've heard people say they've had 10-page, single-spaced pages of all the people that they have resentment towards, which I think deals with people that you think have wronged you and that victim thing. But that's kind of how you start your fourth step. And then you start to see, then you kind of write out what they did to harm you. And then you have to say what was your part in that situation. And that's where I think for some people it's difficult if you were a child and you were incested by your father or something. You know, what was your part in that? You know, I think people get upset saying, well, that child was incested.
Yeah.
And it really is an important balance to make, just in my work with battered women over the years, and the sense of how to integrate a positive 12-step program and assure them of their power and their ability to have their own sense of who they are and their healing, but yet also acknowledge that alcohol or whatever the addiction might be has certainly done something to them in terms of taking that from them, and that they are able to regain that and still not surrender their will to perhaps an abusive partner or to someone else who might take a rigidity toward those steps and use that against them in a very vulnerable state.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Now, some of the strongest criticism of 12-step programs has been from women's groups who have said this might be fine for middle-class, middle-aged white men, but it doesn't address the needs of women or people of color, because we need to be empowered, not powerless. So you heard me implicitly addressing that issue when we talked about the first step, but I wonder if you'd like to comment further about that, and especially from your experience that you just mentioned, could you say a bit more, or would you care to?
Well, it certainly is a controversy, and again, I point back to some of the rigidity, as in any type of movement, when the 12-steppers are looked at or are very rigid about the 12 steps and how it should be done and how they are to come together, and forget the sense of choice and the sense of offering. This is something that you can take what is beneficial and leave the rest. And when people of color and when women are able to look at that and use the 12 steps and mold it, whether it's like Charlotte Kazel has done with 16 steps or Stephanie Covington, there are ways to make the 12 steps beneficial and grow and expand and have that same sense of spiritual healing. It's when you get so opposed to that and throw it all out that I think it's a little sad to not take what you can from it.
So you have, I suppose, as you do among Christian people, those who say it's the whole thing or nothing. And then you have other people who say, well, I like this part and I like this part, but I don't like that part. And so I want to take what appeals to me.
Or sometimes not necessarily just what appeals, but realizing that it might be rather difficult, the amends part, or writing down what one has done. I've heard a partner use that against his wife in court to gain custody of children.
Oh, really?
As she was being vulnerable and writing down and making amends and admitting where her weaknesses were.
Which he had not done.
So
he called that, what she had written down, could he call that paper into the court as evidence?
Mm-hmm. She lost custody of her children. So there's the sense, again, of when is someone ready? Someone might not be ready or might not have the sense of emotional safety. I think sometimes in our vulnerability, we might be so eager to do all of this and have it done and that much farther along the road to healing, and don't have that sense of protecting oneself just a little bit, where we could be exploited or could have someone use control and power against us. I think it's just a slow process.
What is spirituality like with or without Jesus of Nazareth? What difference does it make to put Jesus into the picture or to develop a spirituality without Jesus? May not have been the right question to ask, I think.
It's a great question.
Responses seem simplistic to that question. My first reaction was to think, oh, without Jesus, one would not have the power of the Holy Spirit to strengthen one in this process of overcoming addiction. But maybe in the course of imagining what a higher power is, what God is, someone who is not a Christian might stumble upon the notion of a Holy Spirit or something like that. Is that possible?
Sure, it's possible.
This might be a back door into a Christian awareness. Mm-hmm.
And it has been for many people. not for everybody, but it has been for some. Yes?
I found a difficulty in the past when I'm praying to God, as picturing that God as a big man in the sky. When I visualize the face of Jesus, as we did yesterday in our prayer, it really helps to personalize my Jesus in a way that I can better relate and better communicate in my prayers.
Yes.
I have a friend who is an alcoholic, and she blamed her alcoholism on her mother's zest for the. She was a very strict Southern Baptist and inflicted all sorts of things on the kids. Well, she made it through the program somehow or another without God, and she now has been sober for 5 years. And I don't know what she substituted. I don't know what her substitute for that was, but. She obviously wasn't going to be in touch with God for a while anyway. And maybe she lives in Arizona now, so she might be, but I don't know.
We have to distinguish, I think, between our awareness of God and the presence of God.
Yes.
And so I would want to say that whenever anyone overcomes alcoholism, or whenever a wound is healed, or whenever a disease is healed, that's God. But the person involved may not be aware that it's God,
yes.
As she apparently was not.
No.
I'd be happy if there are some of you who have participated in a 12-step group, and if you were willing to tell us a bit about what it felt like, or where you went with it, or what difficulties you had with it. Because people's experience of these 12-step groups is very different. It is tremendously helpful for some people, and it just doesn't help for other people. So I don't think we should put up the 12 steps as the ideal, wonderful, uncriticizable principles. But on the other hand, I think that these 12 steps are contain a wisdom about human life which is applicable to non-alcoholics just as to alcoholics. And of course, I'm not nearly alone in that opinion. So, let's change the question a little bit. Do you think that the 12-step movement has something to learn from the church, or that the church has something to learn from the 12-step movement?
One of the things that I found in a 12-step program that I have had a harder time finding in the church is the freedom to be totally honest.
Uh-huh.
And to express views that are, you know, that may not be exactly in line or exactly in keeping. Because in an Alcoholics Anonymous community, you can say, I really think the fourth step is a waste of time, and I don't see any reason to do that one. I think you should just skip to number 9 and then go back to 3 and then you're done, or whatever. And it doesn't matter what you say, or I think this group is, you know, full of a bunch of hypocrites. And people will come up and say, I really am glad you shared that, and I hope to see you next week. And I think that there's such a value in that for people. And I have seen people come in super angry and yell and scream and talk about what a lousy program it is and be loved until they were able to see what the values were. You know, and it's people who really need that love and support, who need to be critical, who need to know that I can say whatever and these people are still going to be here. They're still gonna hear me, they're still gonna care, they're still gonna want me back. And I don't find that in churches. I find in churches, there's, you know, a box of a certain size, and we really want you in that box, and if you're not, we really have a hard time dealing with that.
Now, from your knowledge of your congregations, what could be done to increase the openness or the opportunity to be totally honest? Yes.
Churches don't really, the ones I've been to, have any setting for sharing what's going on with you or what your fears are or really anything, any kind of a safe setting. I mean, it seems to me that one, I haven't been involved in a 12-step program, but it must be kind of a relief to walk in people already knowing that you're there because you're alcoholic and that you're not perfect and that you've got some, you know, you're there because you want to deal with a problem. Or when you walk into church, if you started saying, you know, I'm having trouble this week because I'm angry with my mother and my sister and I'm taking it out on my son, I don't see any supportive foundation for that, and I think that, you know, there's counseling available, like through medical providers or other things, but they're almost always deliberately non-Christian or non-religious. And I think it would be wonderful to have some kind of settings where you could go in and have that kind of discussions and figure out that other people have those problems and talk about how to deal with them or how to get forgiven for them.
And there are some of us who like such a group and other people don't. Some people like from the congregation only an ex, don't get too close to me. And other people want to get real close with other people. So the question is, how can a congregation accommodate those of us who like that kind of very personal support group, we might call it? Such things do happen in congregations, in Bible studies and prayer meetings, small group prayer meetings, but perhaps not to the same openness that the AA group has. Another factor, of course, that's different about AA is that you are anonymous and you're not in the congregation. I can be just Brad and I'm an alcoholic and no one knows that I'm a pastor or a theologian, and it's kind of nice not to have that burden of expectations laid on one. Or I'm a CEO, or I'm this or that or the other thing. I'm just me in an AA group. But in the church, I'm there all the time. People know my last name. They get to know my occupation. They know my family. And that has other strengths than the anonymous side of it. But it's more difficult to be totally open. Yes?
In that light, I'm sure some of you are familiar with the DAP Crystal movement, the Crucio type movement. And they work this. Women come on weekends, retreats. We have women first, you know, and men. Sometimes there's together. But one of their basic things is when you come in, you learn their name, but you don't find out, you don't ask them what they do or what their problems are. And it's a whole weekend of sharing, just opening, bearing your own problems and that. And you find a group, you know, no matter where you're coming from, whether you're pastors or laymen or if you had a lot of problems, an alcoholic or whatever, you all seem to be able to share and share alike and support each other. And then after that weekend is over, you have your new groups where you can continue this sharing and caring and praying for each other. And it's really, you know, just a phenomenal type of help for anybody and everybody. Once you've gone through it, and I think it's strengthened a lot of our Lutheran churches back in the Minnesota area and in other areas. But it's because you've gotten that point to where you can come and you can share no matter what. You can share. And, you know, we should look at our churches as, should I say, possibly like a hospital. We're all sinners. We're all in need of something. We come to church. We come to be renewed, to be helped, and then we go out again. Look at our churches as a healing place.
I like that vision of the church very much, and I tend to think that the Lutheran common confession in the service is a way of reminding us of that view of the church. Some of us may get tired of confessing our sins every time, but the point of it is that we are not the righteous ones who have gathered here. And all those other people who are out golfing or hiking or sleeping or whatever they're doing are not the sinners, and we are the righteous ones. That's the, for me, one of the main points of that general confession. Some churches don't have such a confession in their service, typically Baptist churches, for example, or other Protestant churches. And there's more of a tendency there officially to say, we are the saved, the righteous, and the rest are not. So this view of the Lutheran Church, at least, and others, that we are the needy ones, is at least in theory there. But in practice, when we get dressed up and we go to that place, we're on our best behavior, and we want to be seen as pious and good and helpful and loving people, and it's very difficult for us to bring out our problems and to be honest with each other there. Any other thoughts about this problem of honesty in the church?
I was just going to say, for all the controversy around 12-step groups in the women's movement, I've seen a strong preference from women at shelter to go to a 12-step group over going to a church for those reasons of honesty and judgment. And many of them very deeply wanting that spiritual strength that they would receive from their community of faith if they could return to it.
If they could. So you don't get the same thing from a 12-step group that you get from a worship service. They're different kinds of experience. And perhaps we need them both. Or at least some of us need them both.
I really feel that the Christian church needs to have a more formal program to help people get into small groups.
I agree.
There, you can't be open with 200 people, but you might be with 8.
And I think the church needs to be more than a worship service on Sunday.
Mm-hmm. That's what some people want. They just want the minimum.
Right. But, you know, I mean, the thing with Alcoholics Anonymous is that you can go in, not say a word, not say your name, not share anything, get up and walk out. Or you can go and you can share. Or you can give people's phone numbers. And, you know, people there, that's another big thing, is they give out, everyone gives out their name, their phone number, their work number, when you can call them. And people say, call me anytime, call me 24 hours a day. If you need somebody, we'll be there. I don't hear that in a church. In a church, you come and you're there for months or years, and nobody ever says, here's my number. If there's anything I can do for you, give me a call.
You know, I have to say, in some churches, you know, they have developed a program which is called the Stevens Ministry Program, which is, you know, on a one-on-one basis to support one another, to be caring there, to be there for you. you know, where you can, where there is a regular contact over as long a time as it is needed. And I think that's a wonderful thing. And that certainly confidentiality is very much stressed. And you certainly see people then, after they have been, you know, in a Stevens ministry program for a time, then they will move into small groups. I mean, that's how it is in the church where we go to in Salem. The small ministry, the small group ministry is really getting developed. And more groups is added every year.
How do you spell Stevens?
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 I think S-T-E-P-H-E-N-S. Stevens Ministry. And it's a program where the leaders go for, you know, a training for a couple of weeks training, I think, and then they come back to the church and, you know, develop this program.
And how do you spell the one you're talking about? Crusade?
So you are S-I-L-L-O, or in the Lutheran movement, it's Via di Cristo, V-I-D.
V-I-D initials?
V-I-D-E, and Cristo, C-R-I-S-T-O.
Yes.
Supporting what the people have been saying recently about smaller groups, I find that that's really been a revelation. I belong to a very small church. We have, I would say, about 400 members that are actually formal members. We have about 15 ministries, ministries that. The appreciation ministry, an outreach ministry, a prayer ministry. There are many of them, and that gets us down to a level where they're probably 8 to 10, and you know, and it really works out well.
Okay, I think we'll draw the discussion to a close, and your own summary might be different from mine, but let me draw together some strings that we have unraveled here during this hour. We've said that there are many kinds of Christian spirituality, and one of the questions is, how does it relate to those spiritualities which are not from within the Christian tradition? And we've looked specifically at one which is sort of Christian, because the people who started it were deeply Christian, but who very explicitly says of itself that it is not Christian and it is not religious. And we have then looked briefly at each of the 12 steps, and we have asked the question, how do these relate to Christianity? And we have asked the question specifically, what can the churches learn from the 12-step movement? So, thank you for today. I wish you a good rest of the Saturday.